Welcome to Speech Acts, the podcast of Pratt Fine Arts Project 3rd. Each month, a faculty member sits down with artists, curators, and cultural producers whose work engages deeply with social, political, and community-based issues. These conversations explore practices that defy traditional categories, experiment across disciplines, and respond to the urgent conditions of our time. I am Carlos Mota, Associate Professor of Interdisciplinary Practice and Artist. Today, I am fortunate to speak with Taja Cheek, a Brooklyn-born curator and musician based in New York City. Taja is presently Artistic Director of Performance Space New York, a radical interdisciplinary performance institution in the East Village, founded in 1980 as PS122. She is also known as a multi-instrumentalist and songwriter who frequently records and performs under the name Lorraine. Taja was guest curator for the 2024 Whitney Biennial and led performance programs at MoMA PS1, including Warm Up, a summer outdoor music series that the museum has hosted in its courtyard since 1998, and Sunday Sessions, an interdisciplinary performance series. As a curator, Taja has championed the creation of new performance works and has worked closely with artists for many years. Experimental and emotive, her music explores composition and structure and addresses themes of grief, identity, emotion, and experience. Taja, I want to maybe start from the beginning. I know you're a New Yorker.
Yes.
So I wanted to ask you about what it meant to be a New Yorker when you become an artist. And what were the influences? Maybe if you can talk a little bit about your world growing up and how that may have started to shape your vision as an artist and a cultural producer.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot that I took for granted. You know, it's like, how does a fish describe being in water? And only now am I really starting to understand how being here really kind of shaped my world as a kid. I have like a very distinct first art memory of learning about the Sensation exhibit at the Brooklyn Museum. And I remember my parents telling me about it and bringing me to go see it. And I was just like, oh my God, what is this? Like, how can this be art? Just kind of reflecting on my time in school, I'd been realizing that so many people that I went to school with are now in the arts, and I didn't think of it as being, it wasn't an arts high school, it was nothing like that. But you know, there a lot of my friends from school are, you know, either running institutions or are full-time artists or are doing something in that sphere. So I guess it was always kind of, art was always around just because I was in New York. And also at that point of my childhood, it was free and accessible. And so I went to a lot of DIY spaces, DIY galleries and venues, but there was also just so much available for the public to see. I've been thinking about it, and it just doesn't really exist in the same way as it used to. You could go, there were maybe like three or four different free music festivals that you could just kind of go to. And I was a kid that didn't have a fake ID, so it was really important for me to have things that were free and accessible. it's just a noisy, crazy place, and there's so much going on. And only now am I realizing that like that probably had a huge influence on everything that I do now.
But how is the beginning of you thinking of yourself as an artist?
I remember mostly, you know, I'd been studying piano and had been playing cello because the school I went to, you had to like pick an instrument. And funnily enough, I took the recorder very seriously. I was like in a Baroque recorder quartet with my teachers and was like reading like Bach music for the recorder. I wasn't really writing for myself, but I would find often that when I would make mistakes, when I was playing things that were already composed, I would find like sparks of interest or would find harmony that I found interesting. And that was kind of like this rupture that allowed me to just be creative. And so I'd start like you know, going on these tangents when I was practicing, and I would find harmony or melody and other things that were interesting from that. And yeah, we kind of like sing with friends in the hallways, and we kind of like secretly make recordings. And some of those I still have and still use in albums that I work on. But it was, yeah, just kind of a period of self-exploration. I don't think even as I was doing that, I thought of myself as an artist. It just felt like a sort of unattainable thing. It was just, I just thought of myself as being creative in my room and making things. I don't think I actually thought of myself as being an artist until it started becoming a job, which, you know, is something I really need to like, I'm trying to like parse apart a little bit, but that's the honest truth of it.
But you went to school for art?
I went to Yale and studied, I thought I was gonna study music cognition. And the professor that was kind of leading that, it wasn't like a full major or anything. It was just something that they were kind of offering, and it was a new exploration. He ended up leaving, and I decided it wasn't really what I wanted to do. And so then I kind of did this loosey-goosey major, American Studies, that was more of like a cultural approach to history, I guess. And a lot of it was performance-based. So I took a lot of dance history classes, music history classes, things like that, and also some practice. But I spent a lot of time in the art school. And that's where, yeah, I just felt more at home there than anywhere else. And a lot of my friends were sculpture majors. And at Yale, that's kind of where anyone doing anything that has to do with, like, I don't know, performance or media or video, they were all kind of in the sculpture department. So I would hang out there and go to lectures and, yeah, just mostly hang out.
So hang out as a kind of formal education as opposed to a syllabus or a curriculum.
Totally. I mean, I did take some classes in the School of Art too. But I feel like most of my education, honestly, was just like being in the studios and talking to artists and just talking to some graduate students and going to crits and like understanding what that whole world is, which is really not something that is so much a part of a music education, but it was something that I was learning that felt more resonant to me, like the kinds of conversations that I was having in the art school are very different than the conversations I was having like in the music studio or in the music program. And I was way more attracted to that. And then I started, you know, learning about like different histories of like performance and music that, that I just felt like I wanted to be a part of.
I've heard you speak about how maybe the art world has given you different kinds of opportunities and discourses around your work than maybe the music, field is more limited, right? Can you speak a little bit about that beginning, how that interdisciplinary conversation may have shaped your ideas and how you work?
A lot of the curriculum that I was learning was more of like an 18th century romantic thing, which I love and is some of my favorite music, but it's not my whole world. And so I kind of struggled with the music curriculum because it was really just like so heavily centered around that. And the students were really kind of like so resistant to anything else that was not that. So I would end up taking a lot of like electronic music classes and composition classes, and those artists were way more open. And those curricula, like that curriculum was really more broad. And a lot of those artists too are sort of like engaging in a more contemporary art discourse, as well as like a music historical lineage. And so that started opening me up a little bit. And then I just happened to have a lot of friends that were visual artists. And so, I just ended up spending a lot more time there and started making some connections for myself. And I grew up as a dancer. So that was always kind of like, I generally think about music as like a form of dancing in a way, like the ways that my hands move or the ways that like my mouth has to move to be able to sing or all of those things like feel like choreography to me.
So speak more about that interdisciplinary conversation that is also at the core of what we are working on with students at Pratt. We want to, you know, think about how narrowing oneself to one specific discipline may not necessarily be the goal unless you want it to be so. So I'm interested in understanding how you shape your discourse and language in the terms that you're talking about now.
I mean, it's kind of a buzzword now, right? It's like multi-hyphenate or whatever. Mm-hmm. Like I kind of roll my eyes at that. But I do think that, I don't know, especially thinking about musicians and especially thinking, zooming out a little bit more, thinking about artists working in performance, there's a lot of limitations that are placed on them, us, and there's kind of like an expectation to use your body in very particular ways or to kind of like show yourself in particular ways, and it can be othering. It doesn't always come from a place of empowerment when, you know, sometimes you don't want to use your body. You're thinking about other things. You have other interests and concerns. And there is a little bit of a, I don't know, there's a skepticism, I think, around like artists working in performance, wanting to paint or to make video or to, you know, create music when there's such a long, long history of that. And there are so many reasons to like not be skeptical of that. But it does end up being kind of like gendered, racialized thing because it's so tied to the body and expectations around like, using your body or showing your body. And so, yeah, I've always felt like very resistant to that. And especially in my current role as a curator and like understanding how it can be, there's a lot of tension around that. There's but so many spaces for performers. And there is a tension, I think, between like performing arts, quote unquote, and like the art world. There's just like a lot of just antagonism there. And so when it feels like there's a mixing of worlds, sometimes it can feel like there's like some kind of top-down mandate or like, I don't know, there's just a lot of distrust around that kind of permeability. But really, I think it just comes from artists. You don't always want to dance. Sometimes you want to do something else. And that's okay.
It seems like in tandem with your career and your development as an artist, institutionally, there has also been, from the visual arts field, I mean, a kind of opening or more acceptance and inclusion of performance practices, both in the gallery and in other forms of institutional inclusion. How was that for you? Like, have you felt a part of this opening? I mean, you've been literally a part as a programmer and a curator in different institutions, MoMA, PS1, and now Performance Space. But can you speak about that transformation of those spaces? And is it a positive thing? Has it worked for you and your peers and colleagues?
Yeah, I think in some ways, I mean, I definitely felt that. The sort of opening that you're talking about, and it really, yeah, it felt in a way, the ways that I was trying to do it, at least, or the ways that I was seeing was sort of like a widening of a community and a widening of access for a broader community thinking about performance. I do think, though, that now time has passed that because performance is more commonplace, that some of the like particular knowledge of supporting performance or, I think everybody thinks that they can just do it without having like studied it either in like a academic sense or in like a embodied sense. And I think that's where mistakes get made, because there is, I think, a particularity of knowledge and care that goes into supporting performance, because performance is about people ultimately, and it's very different from like caring for objects. And sometimes it can be hard for people to understand that difference if you don't have people that are super invested in all of those interrelated, you know, disciplines that make up performance. If you don't have an investment in that, it's hard for you to know. So like, yes, it's everywhere, but like, is it being supported in the ways it needs to be? I don't think it is. And I think the pandemic was a really tough moment, because a lot of people that were doing a lot of that work, a lot of that technical work, a lot of people left. And the sense of like mentorship or learning from someone who was like a lighting designer or a, you know, a sound designer or whatever, like a lot of that left. I was going to a lot of venues, you know, outside of the art world, but like going to a lot of spaces where, you know, there would be one sound person for, you know, a bill of three artists in a gigantic venue like that. They were just so under-resourced because people couldn't afford to stay in the field. And I feel like we're still kind of feeling the reverberation of that. And it's getting slightly better, but in general, yeah, I have worries.
And performance also being so varied, right? Because when you think of performance, especially in an institutional context in the visual arts, you speak about endurance performance and then live performance as public program. Like, can you maybe speak a little bit about those needs, those different needs, and the support that you were talking about needs to be provided for artists to be able to do the work they do without having the lack of knowledge or experience around their practices?
That's such a good question and a really good point too, that performance encompasses so much. And oftentimes, like at a lot of places, and it was the case for PS1, it was also like the education department and the public programs department. So we were doing a lot. We were doing talks and we were doing workshops alongside, you know, film programming and basically anything live or time-based. So like film programming and theater and, you know, performance art and dance and comedy, and, you know, like there's so many different things that are, you know, very related, but also pretty distinct and have different lineages that we were putting under this umbrella, and they all have such different language. And I think that's one of the biggest things that I'm sort of realizing now, reflecting, is that like the language is just so different when you're talking to a dancer or you're talking to a comedian or you're talking to like a video artist, is that like the ways that we talk about all of those things are so different. And so when you're trying to produce it, or like I'm mostly working on the creation of new work. So we're really kind of like supporting artists like at every moment and really kind of like developing work together. If we don't have shared language, it makes it really hard to be able to like work together. So to me, that's kind of like the biggest thing.
So has your task as a curator and programmer in institutions to come up with these structures of support and to shift the institution towards thinking about deprioritizing the gallery space and painting and sculpture as kind of hegemonic forms? And how have you done that?
Yeah, I mean, yes, that has been the project. It's very difficult. I mean, it is literally like a sort of like, it feels like a claiming of space, right? Which is why people get so, I say territorial, not even as like a bad thing, but just like people get territorial over theater spaces because there's but so many. Yes, I think it's, part of it is a translation thing. Like I would often find that a lot of the artists that I was interested in bringing in that, you know, either senior leadership or other curators, like that were working in different disciplines, didn't know who they were. And so it's a lot of education of just like, you know, why, you know, what are these artists doing? Why are they important? And what does it have to do with like the particular program that I'm working on? And then just kind of like a persistence and also having to like have a little bit more of a knowledge of like all of these spaces to be able to like offer alternatives. So it's like, okay, I understand how exhibitions are installed and deinstalled. So I know where the openings are for, you know, a dance performance or, you know, using the galleries in particular ways. That's kind of important, is to be able to like kind of speak that language also, to be able to understand like how we can fit in, or understanding some of the concerns that, you know, people have when you bring performance into galleries. And now that I kind of have a little bit of an awareness of that, I'm able to like offer alternatives or to, you know, just be persistent if I really believe in something happening in a certain way.
But it does seem like MoMA and PS1 MoMA have changed their attitude significantly. And perhaps it is Marina Abramović also someone who changed the game, right? Because she insisted in making of performance not something in between, but actually the main event, and using the galleries. Was that something that was in the air, and how is that legacy of her doing important to how those places are running now.
Definitely. I think there is a difference, though, between the sort of, like, you know, superstar performance artists that, like, even people who don't know much about art know who Marina Abramović is. Right. And being able to also give that opportunity to artists who maybe are lesser known to a general public, but whose impact is important nonetheless and whose artwork is important nonetheless. And so, like, opening up those spaces to make it available as you would to any artist working in, like, painting or sculpture, I feel like that's still, like, a touchy thing in a way, or something that people aren't so prepared for. Or there's, like, a worry also about, like, you know, having a larger audience in a gallery, or what it means to gather people in a gallery for a performance, when the reality is, if the exhibition is open for for, you know, many weeks or many months, there's tons of people that are coming through those spaces, right? But there's something about control that's, like, very tied into those worries about performance, because you can't really control it. You can prepare for it, you can try to, but whatever happens in that moment is what happens, and it is, you know, inherently a response to an audience or the conditions in the room.
But without wanting to create a narrative that goes back to that, because I understand she's a peculiar case in the history of performance, but the Museum of Modern Art seems to have gone in the direction of creating a specific space that is both exhibition and performance space, with the performance lab, right? And I think that has become a place where different kinds of practices are shown. Is that were you a part at all of those conversations, and how that may have affected the way in which PS1 dealt with similar artists?
Yeah, I mean, I think that space is really awesome, and I've seen a really amazing work there. I think there's something, and this is a half-baked thought, but there's something about, like, having a space specifically for performance, where I think the idea is to make sure that it's resourced in the ways that it needs to be, and flexible enough in the ways that it needs to be. But that ends up, like, feeling like a kind of ghettoizing of performance, where it sort of has to take place in this space. And the same thing with the dome. Like, I love the dome so much. It was a very complicated structure to, you know, we had to basically build our performance environment every year, and it took many weeks, many, many people, cranes, permits, tons of resources to put this up, and it would sit in the courtyard for the length of our season, and then we would take it down for warm up. And it was a great space, and we really got to know it, and were able to be really site specific in terms of the programs that we supported there. But, you know, sometimes artists would feel like they didn't have access to the real building, quote unquote, right? Like, they're, like, put in this little space, and it's sort of like, you know, you're being put in your place. And then the implications of that then are, end up taking on these other tones when oftentimes the artists that we were working with were younger or queer or Black and brown, and that was, like, their first entry point sometimes into a museum setting. And they're seeing the discrepancies, and they're like, why is this happening? Why aren't we able to perform in the building? So it's, like, a double-edged sword, I think, in a lot of ways, to have a space that is, like, really fully equipped for performance, which is great. But then what does that mean for, like, the rest of the building? And, like, do artists working in performance have access to those spaces? Do they have to be performing in those spaces? Can they do something else? And will they be taken seriously?
That makes me think of discrepancies in terms of budgets and remuneration.
Yeah.
Can you talk about that? Does that continue to be an unequal field in terms of galleries and other allocated performance spaces and the artists that perform in them?
Yeah. Well, no. Just because people are expensive. I mean, and also, like, you know, people are very expensive. I think there's, like, a misunderstanding of performance as being inexpensive. I guess maybe less so now. But, you know, there was always kind of a thought, like, oh, we can just do a performance here. But, like, people's time and taking care of them, housing them, making sure they can travel, all of that is, like, extremely expensive. Yeah, I think there's, like, a misunderstanding on, like, a budgetary level, for sure, of what it takes to support performance. Like, I always joke with other performance curators, it's like the food budget is always the first to go, but that's always, like, the first thing that you can do to make someone feel, like, welcome and supported when they're, like, working on site for a very long time. And that's not something that, you know, people necessarily think about in other contexts. But that's always kind of the first to go. People are like, why is the food budget so high? And I'm like, that's the only way that we can make sure that people can work long hours. Like, they're here, they're working, they're using their body. It's like, it's hard, it's difficult.
Also, people need to feel welcome in,
yeah,
in human ways. And there,
yes,
there needs to be an emotional infrastructure institutionally as well.
Yeah, and that affects the work very directly. It's like, if you're really supported as an artist coming into those spaces and you feel like you're really being treated well on like a human to human level, that only makes for a better experience for the artist, and that only means that they're gonna make better work too. So there's like a real like one-to-one relationship between those things.
How has the other page of that being in terms of your work as an artist in both institutions and outside art institutions?
Yeah.
Have you felt supported? What is the field in that regard for you as an artist?
I mean, I feel very lucky and very supported, but I think I also maybe like know too much because I have, you know, been on the other side of it where, you know, I just really have clear understandings of, you know, the business side of it, but also the production side of a lot of these things. So it's hard for me sometimes. Like sometimes I feel like my curatorial brain just kind of disappears when I'm in music context or in art context, and I kind of forget the things that I know are important. And then other times I really just get kind of tied up in it, and all I can see is the production and like what's going wrong and how I would approach it differently. And it's taken me a really long time to finally arrive at the point of just being less uptight about it, I guess is the easiest way to say it. And also understanding, like, you know, a lot of the places that I'm going or performing, the people are like, you know, the people that are working, that are trying to support me, are just tired and they're overworked and under-resourced. And like the things that I'm receiving aren't like, you know, it's not a personal attack on me. It's just like, it's just the real material conditions of their work environment. And so like, once I really started to like understand that, I started having a much, much better time, and have been trying to like give to them in ways that I would hope to receive, you know, care, and just like asking if they're okay, if I, you know, sort of understand how a stage is supposed to be set up before a performance or how a sound check is supposed to go, I just like help. And then people, it just like completely sets up a different kind of environment, because they know that I know what they're dealing with and how it can be hard for them, and then it feels more like we're building it together and less like you are the production staff and I am the artist, which has been really a helpful shift.
And I suppose you exist in a pretty unique position in the sense that you know how you want to be talked to, hence when you talk to an artist, you recognize the vulnerability of the process of creation, right? Can you speak about how it has been for you to take on this role in a institution that is performance-centered? I know performance-based also presents some visual art, but really its core mission is to present performance. How do you approach your program? How do you approach these needs and the care that you need to give artists in the ways that you're mentioning?
Yeah, I mean, it feels really amazing to be in a place where, you know, the concerns of performance are, you know, front and center. And I think that also kind of necessarily means that the structures that we create to be able to do that, if we're really being true to what we know performance needs, means like we have to kind of break from traditional ways of organizing as an institution as well. And, you know, I wasn't there for Zero 2020 or any of those conversations or any of that. So I can't really in good faith speak to that, but it does seem like a lot of the conversations and the things that happened there made way for, very directly made way for different ways of working and thinking about how to organize just in really simple ways, right? Like in more, traditional institutions, it's really hard for curators often don't have relationships with other staff
to be frank, you know, like there's a real hierarchy. You're not, you know, certain people are able to talk about ideas and certain people are not. And just like the simple fact of like breaking that to make everybody's ideas welcome, to like try to think and organize more collectively with junior staff and senior staff, like having that porosity is a huge, huge thing, and is not something that happens everywhere. And that seems like so like basic in a way. And there's so many other like real material things of just even the three-part leadership structure, the way the board operates, so many things, but just on like a cultural level, just having that kind of openness and porosity and responsiveness to the community and their needs makes for a very different kind of institution, and one that, because performance, I believe, is like just, it's about people and the relationship between people, that it ends up being like way more conducive to supporting performance.
You just mentioned the needs of the community. What is that community? Who are those communities that are being addressed or that you're making work for, and how are they a part of what happens there?
Yeah, I mean, I think first and foremost, it's a community of artists in New York City. There's a very clear line between, you know, people that sort of come to watch shows and then participate in workshops and become embedded in the community and then make more work and then have a show at Performance Space. Like that happens a lot because there's like a sort of ever expanding network of artists that are in relationship to one another. I think it's really kind of centered around New York in a way, but I think because New York is an international city, that inherently means that it's going to be a sort of like global network of artists that we're really talking about. And that's something that I'm really trying to explore for next season. It's just like artists who aren't based here, but have a lot of connections here and community in like around New York. And yeah, I think also like a network of artists that are also politically engaged in lots of different ways, and are making work that is in some ways experimental, however you define that. But I think those are all the kind of through lines.
Has your own experiments in experimentation and in making complicated new structures for sound and music influenced the kind of work that you want others to make at Performance Space? Are you encouraging experimentation? For example, is that a part of the commissioning process?
Yeah, I think it is. If I understand your question correctly, I think so. I think I really deeply believe in experimentation and it always feels very lofty when I say this, but I think I believe it. It's like the political power of that, to be able to like break away from expected ways of doing things, even in small ways, right? Even in the confines of just an artistic practice, to be able to break away from what's expected can be a spark, I think, that can inspire other ways of breaking away from, you know, what is expected in the norms in like a societal sense. I think ultimately what I expect of myself, expect from myself as an artist, is the same thing that I expect of other artists that I'm interested in, which is really just having, it's pretty basic. It's just having a really distinct point of view and a sense of self that is communicated and articulated in a real way. And I also try to prioritize not just like a single artist, but artists that are not representative of the community, because I don't know if that makes sense, but just like are part of a community, because especially with performance, you're not just inviting in a single artist, you're inviting in, you know, their collaborators and their world. And so like really wanting to think about that, and also world building is really important to me, I think, in a way a certain kind of interdisciplinary. It also often shows itself as a interdisciplinary practice, I think, in a lot of ways, but just like artists that are interested in world building.
I think world building is a key word when I think of your own music. Mm. And one of the things I like about it is that you seem to be really invested in sampling sound that is not perfect, mm-hmm. Different structures that one would be accustomed to hear in terms of melody. But then there's also a deep investment in dealing with emotional issues and feelings, right? Mm. So I'm interested in the ways in which you seem to be experimenting also in ways of telling stories or telling subjective ideas around loss and trauma and grief. Like, can you talk about that? Because I think that sounds very similar to the way in which you're describing your work at performance space as well. But I'd like to focus now on your making as an artist and this world building you're talking about from that perspective of experiment and also addressing issues that are difficult to address as an artist, which is the self and how you relate to a community.
Yeah, well, I'm really glad that comes across because that's something that I think about a lot. I mean, I feel like music making can be very heavy for me. Especially because I was thinking about it from such a technical perspective for so long. And so I think I've like subconsciously tried to build in ways of breaking away from that or not having to worry about that so that I can just like express myself. Like when I'm really thinking about like creating a song, all of the worries about, you know, what is correct or what works or what is right come to mind. And so I try instead to think about collaging and to think about like a flow and what like the song wants to be. I realized that I ended up using that language a lot about like what the song wants. Like I try to operate from a place of not of thinking that there's actually no bad ideas. There's just maybe applications that aren't working. And so I try to save everything. And I just have sessions where I don't improvise much in performance, but I improvise a lot when I'm writing. And that feels like a safe space for me to really kind of explore things and try things out and just kind of do with whatever materials are easiest and quickest for me. I often would use like iPhone microphones to sing into because I like the sound of it. There's that, but also it's just like easy and like you can just kind of throw it away. It's not precious. And so I'll do that and explicitly try to like not think about song structure. Not think about it, but to come to it from a place of like intuition and less from a place of like technical correctness. I think that I try to explore things that I'm afraid of in making music, and I feel like I wouldn't be able to do that unless I created a way of working for myself that was more open, where you know I can have less anxiety and have less worry about you know doing things in a way that people expect me to.
I think one of the things that we see with graduate students often is the difficulty of finding a way for experimenting with form supporting the ways in which they feel about something or we feel about something as artists, right? There is always a kind of difficult leap to take to find that clarity of vision that you mentioned before. Mm-hmm. Can you speak about that process? Like, how do you deal with like heavy things that pertain to the field of trauma, or how you felt about something subjective, and supporting that through formal experimentation and a sound that you make? Because your sound feels very confident, but yeah. It also feels that it's open to identifying with it in an emotional sense. So I'm interested in how are you an artist?
Yeah. Well, I mean, for me, in a very particular sense, I feel I have a practice of just recording my life. And it's something like a journal, but it's like an audio journal. And I always get very bashful around my friends because admittedly the consent elements of these get very blurry. So people are always like, are you recording me right now? But I do that as a way of, you know, I record some like therapy sessions. I record like everything. I've recorded funerals. I've recorded birthday parties. I recorded like literally everything. And primarily it's just a way for me to have a record of my life. And I have like an aversion to photography for a lot of complicated reasons that I don't really understand yet, but having a audio print of moments of my life, I immediately feel like I remember what was happening and I can go there emotionally. And yeah, I mean, all the trauma and all the difficult things that I'm trying to explore are in those recordings, and just kind of taking stock of that as a first step is really helpful in figuring out how form will later make sense. But this sounds very woo-woo, but I also think that, yeah, I don't know. Like sometimes I'll make a song and I'll just have like in the background, like just me talking about something or like revealing something or like confessing something or just like saying my thoughts or like having a recording of some of those traumas in there. And I don't think, no one can really hear them, but they're in there and I feel like it somehow like gives the recordings an energy or a feeling. But yeah, I think just kind of like facing those things and like really deeply incorporating it into my process from the beginning helps me not have to think so much about the form, because it's already a part of my process. It's what I'm thinking about. It's my first thing that I start with. It's usually the last thing I end with if I'm like putting a little thing in the background. Like it's just so deeply in it. And also, you know, it's like my mother's name is the name of the project. It's just like so deep in it that like I don't have to like explicitly confront it. I'm like always kind of confronting it little by little. And that makes it feel like it's less like, and now I have to do the hard thing. It's like the hard thing is all around me.
Right. I mean, because going back to what I often see in conversations with students is that it is hard to separate how a work may talk about something that is painful or reflect some of your feelings, and how to transform that into something that communicates more broadly, right? That it not only it speaks to you and becomes a mirror of your suffering or your struggle, but also speaks, it's transformed to have a kind of public facing translation of that feeling into form. And I think you do that really beautifully, I think, to an extent that I think also becomes about speaking to broader community issues. So I wanted to talk about a song that you released as part of the Transa project, which is People Are Small and Rupture, a reinterpretation of Anoni's songs. Could you talk about, because I feel like that is a deeply affecting subjective couple of songs to listen to, but also pertain to Anoni's broader political project around being different in society, being trans, being all of the things that Anoni talks about, but also comes at a time in which, right, trans rights and trans existence is being bureaucratically jeopardized and erased to some extent of public life. So I wanted to kind of know more about this project. Like, how do you approach the idea of contributing to this album that centers trans music, and how you approach this idea of working with those songs and how it's been in general?
Yeah, I mean, that did feel like a very important departure from my work so far, because I, you know, like you were kind of saying, I do feel a tension sometimes between like, I think a lot about how to make my music, which is so heavily based on my own experience, like what it means to make that universal. And for me, that means like digging really deep into myself. And I feel like the deeper you go into yourself, the more universal it becomes. And so for the Transa project, I really had to like think about it for a while to figure out how to approach it. And I think, yeah, I feel like a lot of my coming of age was like in the company of like queer and trans friends and community. And so it feels very personal to me, and is so like intertwined with my own like sense of self. But still I was like, how do I do this from my positionality? And so as I was thinking about it, I was like, well, I think it would be important to one, just think about, just like trans musicians that are really important to me. And Anoni immediately came to mind as someone that at the time, I don't think was represented on the project. And coincidentally, my label Mexican Summer had just released this project about Black Lips Collective. The book's right there. And so I had been like thinking about this for a lot. And so I was like digging into those recordings, and the particular recording of Rapture, which is a older version of a song that was on Anoni's first record. There was just something about it that just really, I couldn't really stop thinking about it. And it was also such a strange and amazing document of a time. Like William Baczynski was like mixing it, and it was like, it sounded so different from the version that I knew. I just became really entranced by it. So I feel like in a way I have tried to structure my art practice in a way where I can trust my intuition, and also to like trust myself to follow my interests that will to get to a point where things will kind of cohere. And usually when there's like a lot of points of convergence, I know that I'm on the right path. So like thinking about this recording and like realizing that so many of my favorite artists were on this compilation or involved in this recording, and that it was connected to my record label, and that there were all these other connections, that I just found a picture of Anoni, I think maybe performing at PS122, I wanna say, like around the time that this recording that I was interested in was made. And so there are all these things happening, and I just started working at Performance Space. And so I was like, all these things mean I'm on the right path, I think. And then I wanted it to like materially have to involve trans community that is really trans people that are really kind of thinking about community in very tangible ways and are working on behalf of community. And I wanted to make a condition where like, if you are going to talk about my song, you have to talk about all of these other people who are like around now and are doing things now and need support now. And then I thought about the New York City Trans Oral History Project, who I worked with at PS1 very briefly. And I was thinking about ways of organically connecting my usual practice with this song that felt very different in important ways. And recording became the kind of through line, because I usually record myself and include those recordings in what I make. But I was like, instead of using my own recordings, I can use these New York City Trans Oral History Project recordings, so that I have to think, so that I have to, you know,
I have to work with this organization that is like supporting trans community. They're like built into the making of the song and will have to be built into the promotion of the song, as well as all the people that were interviewed and that were included. And it kind of worked, because anytime someone talked about my song, they would have to talk about Cayenne, and they'd have to talk about Imara, and they'd have to talk about also not only them, but their organizations and the work that they do.
So many of my friends are no longer here, that it's almost staggering. I don't go to gay pride because it almost breaks my heart that all of these people that I had in my life, and when I say all, there was a point in time where every week I was going to a funeral. Every week I was hearing some horrible story of girls dying from either silicone or the virus, and it all is surrounded around ignorance. It was ignorance that caused people not to get help.
What has been the life of the song? How did it land as part of the larger Transcend project? Have you been activating it discursively or performatively? What's going on with that?
Yeah. So, I mean, it was featured in this like Transa Selects record, which was really amazing. it was just like a couple of songs from the Transa compilation that were put into a smaller package. And I've been doing events with Transa alongside Imara or Cayenne, whoever, to just like talk about the moment that we're in, and usually, you know, gatherings around like queer and trans community, which has been, yeah, just really affirming and really beautiful. And I look up to them and their work so much. And yeah, haven't really figured out how to do that live yet. But yeah, I haven't been able to wrap my mind around it, but at least that's been the life of the song. It's been like doing these in-person events with people that care about the issues.
So while this song and this context seem to be very specific about that project itself, I do think that the same kind of possibility of identifying exists with your other work, with your other albums, right? And maybe it's not part of this kind of more concentrated attempt at centering trans life, but it is about an attempt to center the constituencies that are a part of your life and also your own concerns. Is that something you've been thinking about in terms of how you have been creating work and will create work in the future? Like, this kind of social engagement around your music?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like so much of my life is centered around my art making, and I really, you know, I try to make work with people that I want to spend time with. And I also want to like do business with people that I want to spend time with. It's just kind of all, you know, if I'm going to be spending so much of my time doing this and I'm going to be spending so much of my time and like and my energy on, if this really matters to me, I feel like it has to be has to coexist with my life in a seamless way that feels like pleasant and worthwhile. So yeah, the people that I play with in my band, for example, are, you know, my best friends, and I have a very close relationship with everyone that I work with, and it's all like very intertwined, like kind of purposefully. So I started out the project not wanting that at all, and then it became very clear that that was kind of the only way to operate. But in general, I think like the political aspects of the work to me that I think about a lot are just like I think a lot about how it will be received, not in like a didactic way where I want people to think or feel certain things, but more that, I don't know, I just think about other Black experimental artists and the ways that we can be pigeonholed, or, you know, the whole story becomes about like a sort of like you know, identity politics that like are, you know, a part of it, but not the whole thing. And so for me, having a sound that's like really hard to pin down and having structures that are a little bit strange or unpredictable, and like the whole way that I've like molded the project is in an attempt to not be tied down and to be, to give myself a kind of freedom that I want like everyone to have, and in particular want like Black artists working in experimental ways to have. And I feel like I've built the project in a way that like I'm sort of expected to do what I want to do. And like that feels really empowering and really amazing. And I didn't think it would work, but I think it kind of has in a way. But that's also, yeah, something that I wish that more artists had. And for me, it's, that's like a political position.
And one of the beautiful things about music is that irrespective of how you make it or what you have in mind, it lands with people very differently, right? Because it
yes.
moves you emotionally. And I think that the Transa album and your song in it have that very strongly. Is it, you may or not connect to the kind of doomsday scenario that Anony builds in their music, but at the same time, it, you connect very deeply emotionally simply because the music is beautiful.
Yes.
So I guess to round up this point, I wanted to ask you, do you write and make music for someone specifically, like a constituency of people or your friends, or are you writing for yourself? Who's the target audience, so to speak?
Yeah, I always feel so selfish saying this, but it's really for me. It's like entirely for me, and I try to make it like so deeply for me. In ways that are difficult when my work is like very collaborative, but I want it to be universal, the work that I make. And I feel like the only person I have authority over is myself. And so I feel like in terms of like permission, I feel like, you know, I can only really think about myself, or that's the only thing I feel comfortable doing. But also I feel like that's the only way to really kind of go through the other side and make it truly universal, is to be able to like think about myself really deeply. I know that I'm not, the things that I'm thinking about, I'm not the only person on earth thinking about them.
You're unique to you.
No. Yeah. So I'm like, if I go really deep and I just really make work for me, that's the only way that it will actually resonate with people.
Cool. And maybe just one last thing. If you had to speak to my students or mm-hmm. our listeners right now about the complexities of being an artist, making it in this city, you know, dealing with feeling and emotion and creating form, like, what would you say for people who are starting the path that you are already mm-hmm. on? I mean, I don't see
yeah.
to go in terms of like give advice, but more,
yeah, yeah.
more in terms of like what is a word that you can share with other artists who are at a different stage in their path?
I would say the first thing that kind of comes to mind is that, I don't know, I think I always thought that there would be some state of being an artist where, you know, when I was younger, I would think this, I was like, there's a point where you just kind of sit around and you wait to be inspired, and then you're inspired, and then you make the work, and that's the whole process. But it's like all of the conditions of life and of your business, because art making, like, it, if you're hoping to make a living off of that, it is a business, and that is something to really think about. All of those things are the conditions in which you make artwork. And so sometimes you'll have to make things on a deadline, and you'll have to make things that you feel like maybe they're not done, or you'll have to make things that are, you know, like those are the conditions of making artwork. And that I think once I started understanding that, I had a much easier time being an artist or to not like fight with it, but to just recognize that and go with it.
Cool.
Yeah.
Thank you for your work there.
Yeah, thank you so much, Carlos.
This is Speech Act, a podcast of Pratt Institute's Fine Arts Department, with original music by Alejandra Tocatlián.